Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today was supposed to be my guest back at the beginning of the month when he had a reading here in Tulsa. But due to bad weather, canceled flights, and missed connections, we didn't speak. But today, Nathan Englander joins me to talk about his latest novel. Englander is an acclaimed short story writer. His first collection, For the Relief of Unbearable Urges, resulted in him receiving the Penn Malamud Award for short stories. Four of his short stories have appeared in editions of the Best American Short Stories, including the title story from his second collection, What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank, which he's currently adapting into a play. Englander is also a talented novel, and his latest book, Kaddish.com, is his third. The novel opens with Larry, a once Orthodox Jew who has become secular, looking for a way out of saying Kaddish for his father, an 11-month elaborate ritual of mourning. And Kaddish.com becomes the answer. But years later, Larry has returned to Orthodoxy, using his given name of Shaul. He wants answers over who exactly mourned for his father. It's a very comic look at the struggles between modernity and tradition for contemporary Jews, but also for the devout of all faiths. It's a very entertaining novel. Kaddish.com is published by Knopf, and Nathan Englander is my guest today. Nathan Englander, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
I read that you said that Kaddish.com is your most Jewish book by, a force of infinity. As Kaddish.com opens, we meet Larry, a secular Jew who's raised in an Orthodox family who is reluctantly taking part in the Shiva and funeral rites for his father. What was the inspiration for this story?
I have all the highfalutin literary answers for you, but as the years go by, I think I start seeing how many of, you know, the core ideas that like turn into story start with, you know, a joke. Like that I was thinking, you know, jokes, they do what they're supposed to do. They make you laugh, they're funny, but they have no sort of mass, you know, there's not a universe around them in terms of like character and depth. But, you know, like I used to have long crazy hair, I say always, you know, picture share during like Moonstruck, you know, and I remember going to my sister's house, you know, for Friday night dinners, and her friends being like, that hair would make a great wig, you know, that religious Jewish women cover their, you know, heads. And I was like, I remember thinking, that's funny, I get you, good joke. And then it turned into, like, a Hasidic wig maker who wouldn't even, like, speak to a single man in her own neighborhood, like, seeing a guy with great hair in Manhattan and, like, just needing to buy this man's head of hair. You know, like, I started to be able to track in previous stories how a certain comment someone made, something that made me laugh, grew into story. And I think, as someone who is very secular but grew up really religious, I get teased a lot that I'm like one of the worst people at being not religious because I have a pretty religious soul. Like I really don't do anything. I'm not kosher. All the Jewish stuff, like I didn't do any of the things that a faithful person would do. But I feel like friends can always sort of see it on me. My wife is terrified I'm going to be like koshering our kitchen and nailing up mezuzahs, and you know that I'll be Hasidic one day when she, you know, comes home from whatever, taking a walk. So I started to think about flipping in life, and that's where we get literary. Like I'm obsessed with doublings and dualities. My last book, Dinner at the Center of the Earth, is all, every character is actually a different character, basically. And I just was thinking the way in life you sort of get one flip to your narrative. You can grow up secular and be born again. You can be religious and leave. You know, you can be straight and now say I'm, you know, LGBTQ and have a new identity. You can be a drinker who stops drinking, or, you know, but we don't help you start drinking again. Like, I was thinking that you get sort of a single flip. You can go one political party or the other. And then I was like, but wouldn't it be more natural in some of these cases that there would be a flip back? You know, probably not in, you know, sexual identity, but, you know, in terms of, like, political thought or religious background, like, that's the world I grew up in. And I thought, how strange would it be if I was just like, actually, I miss that. And that's one of the core ideas for, like, the guy that we meet, Larry, who is a full apostate, who's left his community, and he's back with his family to mourn, you know, his father's death. And when we meet him in, you know, basically like the second chapter, he's born again. And I think that was the core to that idea.
As you mentioned, Larry, as we meet him, is absolutely annoyed on several fronts. First, by his sister, who has remained Orthodox, and the fact that this is all taking place in Memphis. Larry strikes me as a man where the West begins at the Hudson River. And so, I mean, it's a very funny section, but he really is, at the time, he is just aggressively rebelling against this upbringing that he's being confronted with.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about acts of rebellion. You know, I remember talking to a writer friend and him saying to me, like, it's a whole separate story. We were just talking personally about something, and he was like, talking about how not caring, like that's the real freedom, for something to be irrelevant to you. Like that's truly like conquering it. And I was thinking how much rebellion is like a pushback. You know what I'm saying? It's in response to something. It's its own kind of love is what I was looking at in this story. You know, to like work so hard to be annoyed with your family, to be a pain in it, you know, and torture everyone. It really is. It's not a disconnect. It is still a connection to where you're coming from. You know, that running away, that's an active thing. And I really did want to look at that. And yes, I look at these ideas of place because I guess especially as Jews, and thanks for saying that, and it does make me laugh when, you know, even to acknowledge it myself. Like, first of all, to any readers, like, a book better have the instructions built within. I've been calling it, like, dystopian kosher. Like, if you can read sci-fi, you can probably read about Jews, too. But for me, saying it's my most Jewish book is, I say that with, it's like a real shock and awe. You know what I'm saying? Like, if all my books were already the most Jewish that a book could become, how could something be more Jewish? But the like spirit of this book really goes deep on that front, and that gets to the Memphis part of it, which mm-hmm. is I left that world so long ago. You know, I live in Brooklyn. I speak to you now from Brooklyn. I am like three blocks, you know, from the high school that my dad went to when he was here. But that idea that I've left the world, but my sister who lives down in Florida has stayed in the world, like that was the point of choosing Memphis. Like, weirdly, for certain cultures or certain groups, the idea of what home means, I was thinking, wasn't about, like, if you're born with a subway and you grew up with a subway, you're still home. It's more, in a Jewish community, it's a certain way to live. And I've been fascinated when I travel that wherever I am in the world, it's these strange, you know, in a beautiful way that they're carbon copies, that's what makes the connectivity, especially for a people that's been chased around a lot. Like, what crosses time and space is this idea of a home that can be, yes, tied to a specific place, but really more tied to, like, specific ideas and the way a community lives. So it sort of does shock me that, to me, Jewish life is suburban New York, but that when I get down to Memphis or to Florida, or I was just in Moscow for book tour or in Paris, like, if you go to any of those communities, you're like, oh, yes, this is my food, this is how we dress, like, this is, you know, the jokes that we make, and that sort of fascinates me as this sort of mobile home, not the constructed thing, but yeah, you can punctuate it how you like, a movable sense of home.
And this instigating event that occurs in Larry's life is, as the son, he is expected to say Kaddish, the prayer for the dead. And for those who are not Jewish, this is a major undertaking.
Yeah, so that's what I was, as a storyteller, I'm looking for pressurized form. Like, that's the idea. Like, what makes you want to read a book is you want, you know, a reason to invest in a world. So I was trying to think when I was exploring these notions of, you know, home and continuity and rebellion and all of that, the thing that seemed most pressurized to me, the largest thing that I could come up with to like either have a bridge or a rift between a family would be the Kaddish, because if you're on the religious side, like this is you advocating for your dead relative. Like you have to say this for 11 months. You have to say it, you have to pray in a group, so you have to go to synagogue three times a day. You say the prayer eight times a day, and you cannot miss one. And literally the kind of traditional idea of it is you are, you know, like the soul is going to, you are keeping, you know, dad out of the hellfires. Like you are the earthly advocate. And I thought on the religious side, it is so important and such a giant commitment and has to be done. And then back to my job as a writer needing to feel for both sides, it is just too much to ask of your, like, you know, working in branding, New York, you know, pot-smoking Brooklyn brother. Like, he's just not going to be able to do it. It's just too great an ask, and that sets up for me, you know, the tension of a book.
I would think in contemporary Jewish American society, this is a real issue.
It is a real issue, but back to the niceness, I get maybe more nostalgic or it's kindlier in certain ways. Like as the years go by, I've been really thinking sweetly about the strictures of religiosity. Like Judaism, if you're traditional, it really asks a lot of you. But I like that there's a lot of fixes, you know? Like if you can't make it work, first you ask people to do the traditional thing and then you try and figure it out. So the point is it really is bridgeable. Like you can, there is this Jewish idea of proxies. Like you really can have someone do it on your behalf and then problem solve. Like it is really fully kosher and okay to like hire a student to say it for you. And then it's just as good. It really counts. And what I did was I put it on the internet and I created this site, Kaddish.com, for the book, where, you know, he's poking around being naughty on the internet and he stumbles upon this site. And that's the real engine for the book is, you know, when he's born again and wants to find the person who basically, in a sort of biblical journey kind of way, like he feels like he's lost his father's soul and needs to buy it back. And back to that, I literally just spoke to someone who called me about it. The book hadn't been out for a month. Like,
and there's now a site.
Kaddish.com.
There is now a site.
Yeah. Oh, good. So you already know. I just found out they just called. Like, somebody called to ask me. Like, it's so crazy to me. Books break their boundaries, and that always tickles me. You know, back to the early stories, like I wrote a story about a Hasidic man who needed money to pay for his little synagogue, and he has a big belly and a white beard, and he worked as a Jewish Santa Claus at Macy's. You know, that was the premise for the story. Like, in the last 20 years, I've met basically every Jewish Santa in America. They are legion. I had no idea there were so many. Stories break boundaries. I'm honestly tickled that, like, less than a month after dreaming up, you know, putting this book into the world and this site that I imagined, and there was just, you know, contact us if you want to buy the site, someone has literally bought the site and is making Kaddish.com real.
Wow, that is crazy. Before we leave the first section of the book and talk a little bit about what happens later, there's this touching scene that Larry recalls between his father and his father telling him he is a good son, he is a good man, and not in a shaming sort of way or a manipulative sort of way, but really honestly telling him that. And he's talking about, you know,
sincere.
When we get to heaven, there'll be a place where we all go and we sit around the table and we study the Talmud together. And he goes, this is heaven and hell. And for many people, it will be heaven to spend eternities poring over the Talmud. For those that aren't, this will be hell. And I just kept thinking of this moment as this story unfolds, because as you mentioned, Larry does use Kaddish.com. A young man says, I will be happy to pray for your father. And only after the Kaddish is finished and there's a letter and a picture, does Larry's world start to unravel?
Yes. Well, I guess that's, I just was thinking of my own education. Like, the more I write, I think so many writers start really close and like slowly move away from their own experience. But for me, it took me a long time to recognize the difference between like shy and private, as you can tell. I like to talk. You know, I'm not shy, but I am private. So I used to move so far from my own experience. You know, my story about dreaming about being a writer in suburbia, I said in a Stalinist work camp in 1952. You know what I'm saying? I moved into a prison. But more and more, I'm like being able to look at my own life and say like, oh, I want to explore this. Because your own life, however odd or specific or wonderful or bad or bizarre, it's just that's the only life you've ever known. Like there's this weird stepping back that one can do. And I just started to think about those stories, like, you know, as you sort of hit puberty, I feel like the rabbis start giving you conceptions of heaven and hell and responsibility. And so many of them are both so, I just was thinking about them, and they're so wonderful and also so terrifying. You know, and this is this idea, like, I don't, maybe it was the Greeks, it wasn't a Jewish idea originally, heaven and hell. Like, we got that from someone else. You know, it was Sheol, first it was limbo, but it's always more the notion of the world to come, like a singular world, and all these heavens that they gave us were the same place. So like you said, if you're a good kid and you like to study, then you're in heaven. If you're a bum and you want to play games outside, then you're in hell. You know, and the one that really spurred part of this book and appears in the book in dreams in a different way was that heaven is this infinite feast. You know, all the foods you ever want, like everything you could ever dream of, everything plenty kosher, all that stuff, and you recognize that God has taken your elbows away. So you have sort of these like broomstick arms, and that's the notion. If you're like a selfish and greedy person, you're just going to be flailing about starving. But if you're kindly, you'll feed the person across from you, they'll feed you back. So it's like that idea, the same feast is either eternal starvation or eternal, like, kindly, you know, feeding each other, you know, generosity and, you know, a feast. And yes, I started to think about all of them, and they really both fascinated me as a kid and terrified me. The worst one to tell, you know, teenage boys, they would say, when you die, basically, you know, in the next world, you're sitting there watching a movie of your life with God on one side and your mother on the other. And I was like, that is a terrible, terrible end for a teenage boy to face.
Yeah, no, that would encourage long, long life.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
My guest today is Nathan Englander, a writer, a distinguished writer in residence at New York University, author of novels and short story collections. His latest novel is titled Kaddish.com. It's published by Knopf. As the second part of the book unfolds, we move forward 20 years, and Larry, after this existential moment at the end of his Kaddish, he's now returned to orthodoxy, as you were mentioned, this switch and switch back. He's now going by his Shol, his name, and goes by Shuli, and he's now teaching at yeshiva. He seems to take it up with all the zeal of what we would refer to as the converted, but then an incident happens with a young student that brings back these memories from 20 years.
Yeah, well, I like this idea, you know, again, back to how personal feels, and like, I don't know if anyone's goal is to ever stop growing or ever stop discovering, but I think I look at that a lot like, you know, I am definitely a grown-up now. You know, this is my fifth book. I've been writing for 20 years. Like, I'm, you know, 50 looks around the corner. It's coming. You know, and it's that idea. I still feel almost like a little kid. Like, this idea of the imposter complex really interests me. You know, ideas of confidence and feeling, like, set in your life. So I like this idea that he's come back. He's born again. He's, you know, got his family. He's in living the life that he leads. And he meets, you know, one of his 12-year-old rebellious students. You know, he sees this kid's father has died in the summer, no one heard about it, and this kid's not saying Kaddish either, and it sort of undoes him. It's like that idea of the different levels of self-discovery. Like, he really thought he was a changed man and had found his final form, and I like that idea. You know, maybe this is part of a writing life spurs this, because I always say, like, if I was a gymnast, there's not enough, you know, cortisone shots in the world. Like, my career would long be over. But with writing, there is this constant sense. Every time you start a book, I feel like now I'm ready to be a writer. Now I have the idea. Like, now I'm ready to work. Like, this really, it's my fifth book, but it feels like the one I've been waiting for. And I think, you know, that's maybe the way I see Shuli, where he thought he was like a fully formed adult man, you know, a dad, a respected teacher, you know, living his one true life. And then how easy it is to see one kid hear one thing, and it literally just pulls the rug out from underneath him. It's, you know, he really ends up understanding that there's still this giant hole that needs to be filled. Like, that's what drives this book, is he's just trying to put everything right.
It was very interesting. That first section almost feels like a story in of itself. Did it start out as a story, or was this idea of converting, you know, changing and changing back the sort of the impetus for a novel, not necessarily a story?
You know, for me, a book is not functioning unless it really, really, unless people are alive to you, unless it forms a world. So back to the structure, I'm really interested in negative space, because that's, you know, that's what makes things vibrant to me. You know, if anyone's liking this interview, I'm enjoying it on my end. But part of what makes it real, us talking, is that we're missing our whole lives. Like, you and I are, you know, this is our relationship happening now, and it's the absence of all those other things, like how we got to this moment, to this call. I feel like that's part of what makes it real. So I always pictured it, you know, I always knew there was that front piece and then this, you know, this blank space. Like, that jump was really exciting to me, that we just find him 20 years later. So, yes, I thank you for that close read, because that front part really is a set piece. But I'd always been so excited structurally about this jump. But as for a story versus novel, this is, you mentioned I was a teacher, and I love to scream at my students about this. I think writing becomes really freeing once you stop trying to categorize what you're doing. You know what I'm saying? The students will be tortured, like, is this YA? Is this adult? Is this a memoir or autofiction? Or I was like, just do your work. So why this book is, you know, a year after my last one instead of my usual 5 or 10 is I think I finally took my own advice. Like, I just sat down and started writing it and didn't call it anything. So I did start it as a story, and then it just, much like myself on book tour, it just got fatter and fatter every week. And then I was like, oh, I think this short story is no, like, it's broken its bounds. So I didn't know what I was writing. Like, I think people around me knew, but it really came to me, and like, it came as, again, I pause and stutter because I'm afraid to say it out loud, because it would be nice if it happened again. I don't know that it ever will, but it's, you know, it's 3 years for a rough draft for me. It was like three fever-filled months. I just was, you know, the rough draft. Again, I still pulled out handfuls of hair and rewrote for years and did all my usual craziness and tortured everyone around me to get it just the way I wanted. But yes, that initial draft really just, it just appeared.
Without giving too much away, what I really love about this Shuly as he's going through this existential moment of reliving his failure to say Kaddish is this sort of escalates so much in his mind. He's equating it with Esau giving up his birthright, and that's what propels the second half of this novel, which I found one funny, sad, and touching all at the same time. He's got a compulsion that has to be scratched, or he's just finished.
Oh, really? It's a pleasure to talk to you. Like, yes, this is so what it's about to me on that end, because that's also, I think if you grow up in a black and white world, which I did, and which so much of America right now is about these absolutes and not seeing another side and not seeing a gray space, like so many things that we do can fit in a bunch of categories at once. So like that's part of it, is a deep faith, and it also is this deep compulsion, like he has to fix it. And I also think, you know, I guess so much of what I think about America now, like it's the way, you know, the moment in which you live feeds into your creative mind. But so much of the extreme battles that we're having in this country as people, as individuals, comes back to readings of a specific line. You know what I'm saying? Whether it's Alabama and Roe v. Wade today, or the Second Amendment or the First Amendment, you know, like we take a line and, you know, and we all look at it and we all see different things. And then with a ferocity, you know, fiercely believe in their absolute reading of it. So, yes, it was really important to me. You know, when readers come up to me, which means a lot, like I've been touring this book around the country, and they'll say, like, well, that's kind of a fierce reading. Like, he didn't have to do this to himself. And it's like, that's the whole point, is like in his belief, you know, in his reading of the law, there is no way to put things right unless he finds the person that he hired and gets his father's soul back. And that's why that I can tell you the moment when a book changes, like when a draft goes to the next draft, when a book changes its form, when it's really finding its true way. And that's when his wife became his wife, you know? Like, she plays such a critical role in the book. Early on when I was drawing them, I had this moment where it said it was important for both of them in this couple that one person study full-time, and they decided that she was smarter, so he's the one who got the job, and she got to study. And she's there in the book, you know, telling her husband, like, you don't have to be so hard on yourself. You can also read the law this way, and I feel like we needed that as readers, and he needed that, and the book needed that, is to saying, like, he just can't not believe this. It is, you know, it's just so part of his soul. He has to put this right. And yes, it is a full compulsion, because I think that's what drives so many journeys. You know what I'm saying? Like, I just watched, and if you haven't watched it, I recommend it. It's just so fascinating. And I can't believe they made it, because I can't believe the guy didn't die making it. But like the Free Solo movie, like where this guy's got to scale this massive, you know, whatever it is, El Capitan, you know, without ropes. Like, you know, there is no meaning to it except that someone decided, like, literally, he should have died. I can't believe he did die. What he did is impossible. But that kind of drive in people, you know, where you put meaning on something that has no meaning without your belief in it, that really fascinates me.
I assume this has informed a lot of your writing, because, you know, as you refer to yourself as radically secular, yet you write a lot about the devout.
Yes. you know what? That's another thing that I think sparked this specific book, because it's like almost living inside my own joke that I would make up. Like, I'm, as I said, like, you know, I didn't keep kosher for Passover, like I didn't fast on Yom Kippur, you know, any of that stuff. But it's like, you know, when I'm working, which is a lot of hours a day, like, yes, I think about Jewish things probably as much as someone who's like studying full time with a beard down to the floor. So it's this weird balance of things. And back to getting to the Shuly thing, it sometimes frustrates, you know, nice readers who ask a question, or a journalist that I'm talking, when they'll want to know, like, do you believe in God? Like, answer me. And I feel like it's, if you ask me about, like, my favorite hockey team, like, you know, used to be the Islanders, I really haven't invested much in the idea of hockey since about the late 80s. You know what I'm saying? So I'm both totally comfortable with this bizarre balance, which is I'm fine with whatever my, like, non-writing self is doing, and yet my writing self is obsessed with this world. And that's why I guess I compared it to science fiction, which is like every story has to have the instructions inside, and every world has to be framed. And, you know, Cormac McCarthy likes horses. You know, I like to think about, you know, kosher food. I don't know. That's where my imagination goes. But I think part of it is I'm a dad now. I have a daughter, and I can see that I'm running out of time with not having to have answers. And I think that's part of where I imagined a Larry turning into a Shuli. You know, we're in Brooklyn where we practice what we preach, you know, at like pre-K, they celebrate. My daughter comes home with a different holiday every day. Like, it's Chinese New Year. It's, you know, Diwali. Like, it's everything. And it's sort of those things now where I'm like, oh, yeah, I guess we celebrate Christmas with Dahlia because they're a Christmas house. And I guess we're Jews. We do Hanukkah. You know, like, we're starting to get to that point.
Right.
And I think I thought about, I'm going to have real answers for her because that's how you make a family. Like, what are we? What do we believe? You know what I'm saying? I'm not going to tell her where Belgians, we're Americans. Like, that answer is clear. You know, like, and I can see that I'm going to need to reflect on things that I haven't wrestled with for a really long time. You know, luckily I have a sane and wonderful wife who will, a balanced person who will, has a much healthier attitude towards Jewish culture, like a much clearer, she will be able to help guide us. So that's good. But nonetheless, I think I'm going to, I could see on the, you know, not the far horizon, on the very near horizon, that I may have to like look at things that I've been really comfortable not looking at. And that made me think of Larry, you know, that idea. What happens if I look and I'm like, oh, I think we're Hasidic now, you know?
Well, hearing you talk makes me hear Larry and Shuli a little bit too, I have to tell you.
Yeah. Yes. Well, that's, I'm happy to hear that. Like, I can tell you the moment. So, you know, it's two books ago now, or however you count backwards, but my collection, What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank.
Yes.
That was the moment where I said, like, I wasn't mining my family history or thinking about things, but where, you know, I have great-grandparents born in America. It's my great-greats that came over. We've been here a long, long time as Jews. And my sister and I, because of our religious education, we're weirdly like children of Holocaust survivors in how we think. And we always made order. Literally, if we'd meet new people, like new not-Jewish people, like, as shorthand, we would say, like, would they hide us? As in the event of a second Holocaust, would they hide us? And that was just our shorthand. Like, oh, yeah, he'd hide us. She'd turn us in. It wasn't a joke. It wasn't a game. It was just sisterly, brotherly shorthand. And I must have been almost 40 or something, you know, in my 30s at least. And I had never stepped back and thought, well, that's pathological and bizarre. But the moment I did, I was like, oh, I would like to read that as a story. I would like to explore that notion and write it, you know. And it was, I can literally map that as a moment where I'm like, oh, some of these things that are just so natural to me, back to our rich and broad country that I hope more of us could recognize has so many people in it and we can all live together well and, you know, empathize and reach across, you know, make connections. But part of it is recognizing that your way is, you know, what's the same and what's different. And yes, that moment where I recognize how truly pathological that was, it just turned into story. And now I've been more looking, and I thought it really was with that sweet notion of heaven and hell where I thought, this is just how I see the world, even as not religious. And I thought, this is a very strange and probably different to a lot of people way to see the world.
Well, it's a pleasure to speak with you, Nathan, and congratulations on a wonderful novel, Kaddish.com. Thank you so much
really,
for joining us.
Thank you for this. It's a joy to talk to you.
Author Nathan Englander is a distinguished writer in residence at New York University. His latest novel is titled Kaddish.com. It's published by Knopf. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.